thoughts.
Yeah, good. So I would, this is supposed to be a discussion, and I know it's always the challenge with these discussion sessions has been they mostly turn into talks. But I really would like this to be an opportunity for discussion. This, I apologize, my UCSB colleagues have already seen me make this joke. In my mind, this is these are all theorists, right? The helicopters, the bandwagon. We're all doing our best to get on it.
Where is the front of
the It's from World War Z, the zombie apocalypse. Okay, so it really does need to be a discussion. So I went through and I worked out. I was only counting experiment LHC. I think LHC 16 only has one or two people who have written papers on this. But of the 15 theorists who are currently part of experiment LHC 16, 12 of them have written papers on this. A total of 15 papers in total. There you go. I apologize if I don't cite all these papers in our discussion, but this is a sign that we've all thought about this a great deal, so I really do hope you feel free to let's actually have a discussion. There's also various pieces where other people have contributed to some ideas, so I will cede the floor to other people at various points so they can say something. All right, so we all know what we're here to talk about. So these were the original conference notes written up about the data release mid-December. Of course, they've both been superseded by newer notes by Atlas and CMS, and so all the discussion I'll be referring to has to do with the more recent analyses. And so to make this a real discussion, what I really wanted to do was just shape it around a series of questions. So I have, in my mind, answers to these questions, but I'm sure you all have different answers, and so I would like us to discuss it. So the questions, broadly speaking, I thought are worth addressing. The first one is just, are we happy with the analysis, right? Every time we have an experimental excess, you have to ask yourself the question, is there anything about the analysis that makes me uncomfortable? My answer is yes. I think as far as we can hope for at this point, the analysis is very good, including the understanding of backgrounds, right? So if there's any fault, it's on the theory end. You could ask, the second thing you ask yourself once you're happy with the analysis is, if it really is a signal, so the problem that we've had with every excess pretty much at the Tevatron and the LHC, every excess during my career, is if you had a signal that was true, you had to have gotten lucky twice in the sense that there was some other experimental result that disfavored the new signal interpretation. So you can ask yourself the question here, do we have to get lucky twice? My feeling is, generally speaking, no. There are many, many explanations for this that are not at variance with any other experimental constraint, so that's very interesting. There's a question about whether it's wide or narrow. Of course, the two experiments differ in this, and exactly what you should think about that is very interesting, and we'll have some comments from Bill asking some questions related to that.
They don't differ statistically significantly.
They do. It's 1.5 sigma, I think. All right. Look, Atlas states that. Look, I also okay, but well, we'll have various comments on this. All right, so we can then decide. Okay. There's a question of is it a resonance or a cascade? So I think as of the early data, it could have been either one. I think now we understand a little bit better. The distributions that we've seen very much more favor the resonance interpretation.
What's the definition of a cascade here?
Is this a singly produced thing that's decaying into pairs of photons, or is this something you have a parent particle that is then decaying, and diphotons are coming either on separate parts of a cascade, or is some particle that's being produced in a cascade, or is it just resonant production of the thing that we see? Okay. So do you expect any other event activity apart from just a bump in the invariant mass, diphoton invariant mass? Okay. These are the Higgs weeks, we should ask the question, is it a Higgs? I think the answer is no, to within any definition of what we mean by Higgs. Okay, a theory question that doesn't necessarily have to have any relevance to anything. You do wonder who ordered that. This was not something that many people were beating the drum saying we should expect to see. And my answer to that is nobody I know ordered that, maybe Paul. And then there's a question, of course, of what to do next. I think the generic answer we appreciate very well, but it's worth discussing a little bit more. Okay, so these are the questions that I want to have us address, and everyone should feel free to weigh in with their feelings.
What about the point of 4 photons where two?
That is definitely the tetraphotons interpretation is also a very valid interpretation. And let's talk about it. I don't have slides on it, but of course it's something that we're all well equipped to talk about. So for those who haven't thought about what Lance is mentioning, of course, right now we've reconstructed this as pairs of photons, but you could have collimated pairs of photons that are reconstructed as an individual photon, and so that falls under the diphotons from tetraphotons, which is, as of this point, still a legitimate possibility. Okay.
So, why isn't it a Higgs?
I don't get the point why it's...
Is it a Higgs? Why is it not a Higgs? Well, there's data that disfavors that interpretation. Okay, so by Higgs, in a narrow meaning, I mean what Howard Georgi would say, which is it's a Higgs if some particles in the standard model get some contribution to their mass from it. And at least this, okay, if it is a Higgs by that definition, it's some extremely small fraction of their mass. But also, the generic, in things like a singlet Higgs mixing or two Higgs doublet model, both of those interpretations are badly disfavored. Okay, so we can talk about how bad it is, but it doesn't smell like a Higgs. Okay, so we've all, I think at this point, seen the data. So this is part of the introductory part. So here's the CMS-13Q analysis. This is the updated version that has the initial data with magnet and some 13TV data without magnet. And then they also do an 8-13 combination. And so what you're seeing here, these are the width field data, the 2.7 inverse femtobarn and 13TV. These are barrel-barrel photons. So two photons that end up in the barrel of the detector. These are barrel end cap. Of course, you don't have end cap diphoton events by the selection criteria. And then here's the zero field data, which gets us from 2.7 to 3.3. Okay, so you can see if you sort of look at all of this, right, there's something suggestive in the barrel-barrel data. There's something mildly suggestive in the end cap barrel data. I don't know. This is actually, okay, this is very small event counts, but it is slightly funny that the only events you get well past your tail happen to pile up at 750. So, okay. So you sort of add it up. There's, let's call it 10-ish excess events that are peaked around 750, 760 GeV. In CMS, there is one analysis with two signal interpretations. That is to say, there's one set of cuts, and then you just inject two different signals. So the two different signals are a spin 0 and a spin 2 signal. And hopefully, Marcus will stop me if I misrepresent anything, but I think that's a correct interpretation of the CMS analysis. Okay, so there are excesses that are, I would say, the same significance, local significance, whether it's spin 0 or spin 2. There's no real preference in the current data set. That's not surprising. We don't have really a lot of events at this point to really know too much more about angular distributions. Of course, when you actually count for look-elsewhere effect, significance goes down significantly. There's a preference. Well, there's no preference for a non-zero width or anything departing from the narrow width approximation. In fact, the significance goes down as you increase the putative width of the signal. And the best cross-section times branching ratio is sort of in the 6 to 7 femtobarn range, around 750 GeV. Okay, so that's the data set. That's what everyone's excited about. And you can sort of look. These are just the p-values for just the 13TV data. I'll show the 13.8 combination later. And this is just for different values of the width. So this is something that's very narrow width. This is something that's approaching percent level width. And then this is something that's approaching a few percent width. And you can see, okay, so you're getting most of the significance here in the narrow width interpretation. There's really little difference between the spin 0 and the spin 2 interpretation. And things get somewhat worse as you increase the mass of the particle. Okay.
What sense does the second graph worse than the first?
Well, this is not a distinctly different. Really, all I mean is this, okay? So this obviously is not very different, but this is. But it's not an enormous difference. Okay. All right, the Atlas. So why are we excited? We're excited, of course, because this is both Atlas and CMS. So Atlas has a few more events. In the revised Atlas analysis, there's two analyses. So each analysis is actually tailored somewhat to the spin of the resonance. There's a spin 0 analysis and a spin 2 analysis. All of the spin 0 analysis events are contained in the spin 2 analysis. And so in particular, the spin 2 analysis just has their normal set of sort of diphoton preselection cuts and the requirement that the PT of photons be greater than 55 GeV. And so this gives them about 5,000 events with an invariant mass of 200 GeV. And then the spin 0 analysis is slightly customized to pick up on the isotropy of diphoton events expected from a spin 0 resonance. And so there's an additional requirement that the leading photon have a PT greater than 0.4 of the invariant mass, and the subleading one have a PT greater than 0.3. And so that gives you a subset of these events that's about half the size. Okay. And so now we see this is the spin 0 selection, this is the spin 2 selection, the residuals. And so there's slight preference for spin 0, 3.9 local, 2.0 global, slightly reduced when you go to the spin 2 interpretation. And the very interesting thing is Atlas says there is a within there's a preference for a width of the particle that exceeds the resolution of the detectors, and their best fit width is on the order of 45 GeV, or about 6% of the mass of the particle, and that's, of course, very interesting. That has very strong implications for your interpretation of the excess.
That's in both the spin 0 and 2?
Oh, well, it's actually 46 and 48, so there's a slight difference, but yes. Yeah. Okay. But I know it's a little hard to tell from the plots how shallow the likelihood is on the direction of width, so that's something we can discuss when we get to the width question. Okay, so then they've shown this. Here's the p-value plot. As local significance is a function of the mass, and then a variation for the spin zero analysis, the width relative to the mass, and so the peak is around 6%. Although there, this likelihood is fairly shallow in this direction, so it's a little hard to tell how significant I should attribute that to. Here for the spin two, they plot in terms of a RSKK graviton parameter space, but the preferred value is in a similar place. It's 46 versus 48. Okay.
The KK resonance at
16. Yeah. Yes, that's right. You have the second. Yeah. In fact, so really we're getting all the KK. Now, of course, this isn't a warp geometry, so you don't expect the resonances to be evenly spaced. But You can still dream of it. All right, so the first question to ask is, are we happy with the analysis? So, you know, there, in my mind, okay, it's a well-defined final state, right? These are well-studied physics objects. There are issues about energy calibration, but the collaborations do an extremely good job of this. Straightforward analysis, they're not using any fancy tools that might induce scales. You're insensitive to some sort of extremely rare backgrounds that might be populated in the signal region. The signal and background are easily reproducible. The only thing that would give, at least gave me pause, and maybe other people have things that give them pause, so obviously the issue is there's a lot of contributions to the standard model diphoton background that are not all well reproduced by Monte Carlo, and so we use a fit. But because there's no good you can't do a two-sided fit, there's no good sideband above 750, so all we really can do, right, is measure things at low invariant masses, take a functional form, and extrapolate it through the signal region. And maybe you could worry that if you're not going through the signal region in the right way, you pick up some artificial significance. So Atlas and CMS use different functional forms. I would say that's a good thing, right? And you know, these have been validated not just in diphoton data, but in digit data, right? These things work relatively well. There's pretty good agreement with the extent to which we can simulate the backgrounds. So it's a slight concern, but I don't think it's a real concern. It doesn't actually seem to make a big difference. And lots of people have had success in reproducing the background fits done by the collaborations.
Can I make it also computed from an NMLO QCD?
Absolutely. So Kieran Williams had a very nice set of slides of Morion. So some of you already know this punchline, but it's worth going through anyway. Okay, so obviously this is something that we can try to compute at NNLO for at least actual genuine photons. And the thing that you might think is, well, okay, we say, oh, look, QCD contributions to that photon are very smooth, but of course there are heavy particles that might give us extra features. And so something he was showing, so this is the ratio of various improvements to the NNLO calculation over the NNLO calculation. And so green is showing you, if you take just the normal five light flavor NNLO calculation and you add the effects of top loops, what does that give you in terms of the ratio? So that gives you this. You get some interference at low masses, and then, of course, a bump, and then things asymptote to the six flavor result. The red is showing you if you take five flavor NNLO and you take some things that you can interpret as partial contributions from the N cubed LO calculation that look like NLO corrections to the gluon-gluon initial state. So this is not a complete calculation, obviously. There are pieces that are missing, and so you shouldn't take this too literally. But if you just take this, that gives you this curve relative to the light five-flavor NNLO calculation. And then if you take a combination of these in some sense, where you add the effects of top loops to the NNLO calculation, and then you sort of have a k-factor scaling of this partial N cubed LO contribution. So you sort of are trying to do the best you possibly can without actually doing the full calculation at N cubed LO, you get this thing. And okay, so hey, you know, without knowing what the axes are, you get a little nervous, right? Because as careful as you can get, calculation of the background has a feature that's not far from 750 GeV. Okay, so what's the reveal? The reveal is these are all very small corrections, right? So that doesn't seem, this is not an indication that we should be actually concerned about. Yeah, there clearly are, there's standard model physics that is happening above the top threshold, right? But the effects appear to be not large enough to cause us too much concern.
What's the k-factor?
This is the only place where a k-factor-ish thing appears, and what this is the rescaling of this partial N cubed LO contribution by the ratio of the 5-flavor plus top over the 5-flavor to try to give you the sense of the top, the effects of having the top in this contribution. Okay.
Isn't this also dominantly QQ bar? So that's what NNLO is.
Yes, well, sorry. Well,
bar this initiated, and here, some of it is...
Here, sorry.
Blue initiated contributions.
Absolutely. So, yeah, sorry. So, I don't think we disagree on that. But these are just meant to improve the glue initiated contribution.
I want to disagree with the experimental spectrum on
absolutely. Okay. Ian, did you have something else?
Yeah, it's something along Scott's...
Okay, so now here he's just showing the NNLO with five light flavors, so without these extra little wiggles, but those wiggles we know are percentage-wise small. Okay, I don't know more, you know, I've only skimmed the paper where this appears, and this is just from his slides from Morion, but the agreement is pretty good, and when you compare the residuals that you just get from taking the NNLO theory calculation versus data, when you compare that to what happens when Atlas just takes their fit, you don't appear to get a very different answer. Okay, so, you know, to the extent that we're capable of saying something very precise about the backgrounds, things seem to agree pretty well with the experimental analysis.
Okay.
Does someone else have other thing? Yeah, so you have
So here's actually, I want to ask a question to our experimental friends, although I pretty much know the answer, but I want to know what they think. That is, usually when you try to fill a pump, you define your control region is a two-sided, you know, whatever is outside of your pump region on both sides. But my question, given that, you know, at the very high tail, the number of events is still very small, the error bar is still very large, is there any room to fit a bump plus a tail in this kind of procedure? Or even given the data here? Could it be that it's a bump plus something else that produces a little bit more tail?
So there's no preference. I mean, so one of the questions is there a preference for extra parameters in their functional fit? Which the answer is no, right?
Well, actually, if you just literally take the atlas functional form, and you just fit the background all the way up to 600 GB mirror mass, you will see that the tail actually come up very different. It's a lot lower than yours. That's why.
Sorry, you're saying this is a lot lower?
No,
this is not lower.
No. I'm saying that if you take the functional form of that atlas given.
You didn't try all these games.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking.
And there's a discredited theory analysis claiming that Atlas screwed up and they didn't.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is when Atlas fit this form, they fit the data all the way up to, say, 600 GB. Okay? But I'm saying that if I think there's a signal in the tail, I would only fit the control region all the way up to maybe 600 GB.
Anything
above 600, I would call that a signal region.
By fitting with the signal shape you're looking for, you should be insensitive to that signal shape if you've got the shape correct.
But that's why it's so crucial that you guys are using a data-driven method, not a QCD-driven.
I think there's no weight to the high mass events.
It's also worth pointing out. It's also worth pointing out that there are two separate atlas analyses. The one that you described so far is using the fit function. Are you going to proceed to the other? Or?
No, I'm actually not. I'm not going to show the second one.
The spin-2 analysis does it completely differently. It takes predictions from theory for background components. It normalizes them in the low mass region, as you're suggesting, and then it just uses those shapes as a predictor for the higher mass region. So we have two completely different approaches in the two different.
So then let me be very precise. Do we know that statistically speaking, how unlikely it is to have a bump plus a tail? As our signal. It's not just a bump as a signal.
We haven't tested that model.
Yeah, it hasn't been tested.
That is really the question I'm asking.
Yeah, so I don't think it's been tested, but you could, I mean, at this point I think there's almost enough information to do a theory level crappy version of asking that question, right? So
anyway.
Could you comment on the left-handed plot?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just that there seems to be, so and what they did for this plot from MCFM was apply approximate cuts that reproduce the atlas selection. So this is trying to give you as good a possible prediction from MCFM. This is what the background.
Oh, this is not Atlas doing it.
I
know that paper.
This red curve is.
Curved. I thought that the Atlas people have.
But I mean, they're okay. To me, this is a good sign.
Yeah,
right? I don't know how people feel about it.
They use Atlas data.
No, he's just. This is right. This is Atlas data. This red line is cured.
I mean, when you're looking at gamma data, you have to be sure about lots of things. For instance, that you're seeing gammas and not pi naughts and things like that. So why
is there surprisingly good agreement?
Yeah,
I think it's actually
they're mostly gammas.
They're mostly actual gammas. Yeah,
there aren't very many.
So this is part of the. Unfortunately, given the length of the discussion, I don't have time to show all of the validation plots that Atlas has, but they do have a pretty good agreement between. So before they arrive at this functional fit, right, they are looking at the composition of their diphoton events, and they are mostly real gammas.
But have they removed things, or it's just that the number of backgrounds is just small?
It's small.
Just
connected? Oh, in the MCFM, I think there's nothing. This is just actual photons, using the NNLF calculation.
But it's not at the percent level.
It's more like the 10% level.
Right. You can check.
Do you know how the plot on the left is normalized?
So I don't.
So that's the question.
Yeah. So I don't. This is now. So in particular, it's a little hard to tell from the residual strength, so I don't know exactly what they mean.
Okay, it's like it's normal to the left side of the data.
Yeah, right. I mean, when you look at the residuals, it's not that great. Really? Okay, sure. So this paper is now, I think, since
it's normalized, it's normalized to the total cross section.
Good, okay, normalized to the total cross. So that's okay.
Only that.
Yeah.
So that's good.
There's somewhere there's a total cross section number, either in the Atlas paper, they just counted the individual bins and then normalized to the theoretical value of the total cross section. And I think somewhere between the lines they say that it's consistent with what Atlas claims in their paper as the photon reconstruction efficiency and so on.
The efficiency
is
quite amazing, isn't it?
It is.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can move by 10%, which is like the total jet fake rate.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little more. It would still look good.
If you normalize to the total cross section, you are dominated by first three bins and you forget about the rest.
Which is clear also from looking at the residuals. Okay. So, all right. I think up to the statement that obviously it is not actual, purely just real photons computed from the NLL calculation that are contributing, that's obviously still a question, but there's no reason to suspect that, say, photons from pi zeros are piling up around 750 GeV. It's a fair statement. Okay.
Is there a chance to get the M3LO cookie?
Oh, there's no complete.
No, I mentioned the
M3LO. Yeah, in the far future.
Far future. Yeah. But this stuff, this like the delta sigma, that is really just pieces terms, and so that is not like you shouldn't believe that for any.
No, you misunderstood me. I was asking to get the full one. How long it would take, but I guess from Lance's reply, it's very long.
Well, no, she has a plot or plans.
All right, so this is the summary of the things that I wanted to say for Are We Happy With Analysis? I don't know if anyone else, does anyone else have questions about the analysis that they wanted to have resolved or things that they're concerned about? Everyone's happy?
I want to go back to the one with the sum of the two that gives you the bump up. It's only 2%. Yeah, this one. Can you think of something that can increase it to much more than 2% because it's right on the right place?
Well, it's not right now.
It's not right on the right place.
Because
it's very hard to.
Because it tells us to be a fluke, then it's either in the.
No, it's very hard because you know the asymptotic behavior. So as you go to very high invariant masses, the top becomes massless, and you have a six-flavor result that you can believe in. So you sort of know there's not a lot of room for changing. I mean, you'd have to change the shape in a very small region, right? I don't know.
Also, the glue initiated part, which is what this
subdominant country
is, like 20% or less. And so how can you make 20% even?
Right. And the glue initiated. So the feature we should emphasize, right? The feature is coming from glue initiated pieces with the top box. And so it's very, because that's a subdominant contribution to the overall rate. It's very hard to imagine.
Then looking at this, do you know experimentally how likely it is to actually see this top threshold?
Said the words experimentally, so...
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at the plot, right? You can see how much
the difference. Even in the future, I mean, is it worth measuring this top threshold behavior?
Well, it's a 1%, it's a 1 or 2% effect, right?
I think we ought to be looking for topology.
Okay.
You meant topology?
I'm topology. In your dream.
All right, so then there's the question, okay, so if you believe the analysis, which my opinion is we should, and I think at this point everyone has rested in peace, then you have to ask yourself the question, okay, if this is real, do we have to get lucky twice? In other words, is there another analysis or data set that would disfavor natural interpretations of the signal? And I was on the record, in fact, okay, this was early rumors, so I got the mass wrong, but I had a very grumpy Facebook post about how these things couldn't actually be a real signal. That was December 10th, okay, so I'm very wrong, so I'm happy to admit it. So why would you be concerned? Well, the first thing you'd be concerned about is, well, do 18, you know, no one made a big deal about bumps in the diphoton spectrum at 8 TeV, and very naively speaking, you expect the 8 TeV data set to have more sensitivity than the 13 TeV data set given the accumulated data. And so this is sort of a plot sketching that. This is just the number of events you expect and not the significance of a signal. If you have some resonance that's produced through various Platonic initial states. This is showing you the ratio of cross sections you get for these different Platonic initial states. And these lines are just showing you the luminosity ratios between Atlas and CMS. So basically, you need to get enough of a cross section boost going to 13 TeV to beat these luminosity ratios in order to have more significance or to have more events at 13 TeV relative to 8 TeV. And just by eyeballing this, you see, okay, in general, you expect, so you could hope you do better if you have things like bottom quark initiated or glue initiated resonances, but very generally you don't expect to have more sensitivity to resonances that are below a TeV. That was sort of the naive expectation going into December 15th, and so that was a source for concern. Is it really possible to have any significant bump at 13 TeV, given that no one was very excited about bumps at 8 TeV? Okay. So then you can just ask yourself the question, all right, so what, in fact, do these 8 TeV analyses look like? So here is this is a CMS analysis at 8 TeV. This is one of the Atlas analyses at 8 TeV. There are, I think, two Atlas analyses and one CMS analysis in the diphoton spectrum at high mass. I think that's a correct representation. All right, so do you not see any, well, you might believe there's a couple excess bumps here. Here it's very hard.
It's a massive dip at 700.
Yeah. So this was using. Yeah. So if you just ask the question, okay, as of December 15th, just looking at the existing analyses, sort of if you were very optimistic, how many excess events could you have? The answer is not really very many in CMS or Atlas. And so whether or not these are consistent really depends sensitively on the production mode, right? So it could be consistent if you were being produced through a production mode that got a large luminosity ratio increase going to 13 TeV. So here's a bunch of different luminosity ratios for various initial states. So bottom quarks and gluons and charm have very large luminosity ratios. And of course, as you get to light flavor quarks, you have much smaller luminosity ratios. Photons have very small luminosity ratios. So it was plausible, at least even as of December 15th, that you could make a lack of excitement at 8 TeV consistent with excitement at 13 TeV as long as you were being produced through initial states that had a large jump in the luminosity ratio. Okay. Of course, then, thankfully, the collaborations have gone actually and looked back at their 8 TeV data with an eye towards understanding what's going on at 750 GeV. So CMS did both a reanalysis of their 8 TeV data and an 8 plus 13 TeV combination. I think the only change that they made in going back to the 8 TeV data, apart from plotting things in a slightly different way, was to revise the statistical procedure they used at 8 TeV to make it consistent with the statistical procedure, including the background subtraction that they used at 13. Is that an accurate representation? So that was the only change that we got. And so now you can see these are just the p-values for, here's, okay, narrow and slightly less narrow. I'm not bothering to show you the wide. And so 8 TeV, this is the p-values for the 8 TeV analysis in blue, 13 TeV is in red, and actually what you see is when you finally dig into it, there was in fact an excess right around 750 at CMS at sort of the 2.5 sigma level, and when you actually combine those, it gives you an increased significance relative to the 13 TeV only analysis. Okay. So their claim is actually in combination, that brings it up to 3.4 sigma local, and it gets you from less than a sigma of global to about 1.6 sigma. So that's CMS. So the situation was better than we expected going into the jamboree. Atlas has done something partially similar. So they've gone back to a reanalysis of their 18 TV data, although there's no public combination of the 8 and 13 TV data sets. The revisions to the Atlas 8 TV analysis are slightly greater. So they used the most up-to-date 8 TV energy calibration, which was a revision from their previous diphoton analysis. And then also, I think like CMS, they revised the statistical procedure to match on to what was done for the 13 TeV analysis. So here you see, here's the 8 TeV reanalysis for the spin 0 selection and the spin 2 selection. And amusingly, okay, at least for the spin 0 selection, which as a reminder is a subset of the spin 2 selection, there are some excess events piled up at 750. There's really nothing apparent in the larger spin 2 selection. And so if you just looked at 8 TeV, you'd say actually there was almost 2 sigma global for the spin 0 interpretation. In the paper, it only says what the number is for the finite width. Is there public information about the significance of the 8 TeV excess if it's narrow width? Nobody knows? Okay. So that's a question if anyone can find public information afterwards. Because you would like to know, for Atlas, do you have to assume a finite and fairly large width for there to be consistency between 8 and 13? Or is it possible that 8 has an excess even if it's narrow width? So that's a question I would love to have answered. I'm not sure there's enough information to do it right now. And then, so they didn't do a combination really of 8 and 13, but they did ask, okay, assuming the natural luminosity scaling of gluon fusion initiation between 8 and 13, are the analyses consistent? So for the spin 0 interpretation, 8 and 13 is consistent at 1.2 sigma. Spin 2, because there's really nothing there, it's a little bit more of a stretch. But I think the answer is diphotons don't kill diphotons. In fact, when you went back to the data sets, certainly for the spin 0 interpretation, both Atlas and CMS actually did pick up some events at 750 GeV. There's no real tension. In the case of CMS, you improve the significance of the bump by combining 8 and 13.
Okay. Spin 0 and spin 2 just refer to the analysis.
Just the analysis, yes. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. So I did try to emphasize that the spin 0 is just a proper subset of spin 2 based on the PT requirements for the photons. Yeah, so in fact, when I say, with respect to the analyses, when I say spin 0 and spin 2, you should really just interpret that with reference to the analysis cuts. Okay. So the other question you should ask, okay, so it's not killed by ATV data in the own channel, but you could imagine if you had a resonance going to photon final states, at the very least, gauge invariance requires you to go to various other states. So in the 10-author CERN paper that followed the initial announcement, they sort of went through a bunch of different ATV limits to figure out what various Dx limits were. So they sort of tallied all of these. And then they asked, okay, if you had a resonance that had some luminosity function, luminosity ratio between 8 and 13 TeV, if we pick the value to say be 5, then what is the relative bound given the observed gamma-gamma rate, which I think they took to be around 9 femtobarn, what is the ratio relative to these final states? In other words, are these final states badly excluded by existing data at 8 TeV? And the answer is pretty much no. So, okay, they're just showing the slight tension with the Atlas diphoton data at 8 TeV. There are better dilepton limits, but then as you go to any other final state, the bounds from these other final states are weaker as of the 8 TeV data set. And even as you get into things like digests, the bounds are much, much weaker. So, if you had some generic object that was decaying into various pairwise final states, it's totally plausible that the first place you would see just diphotons. So that's another sense in which there's really no other experimental measurement that disfavors this being signal. Okay, so to say anything more precise, you have to write down a model of some sort. So what's the minimal model for this? So the minimal model for this is just to imagine, I'm going to imagine for the time being of a spin zero particle. Spin two is just an extra complication on top of that. But just imagine you have a spin zero particle. If CP is a good quantum number, you certainly know you have something of the form of a coupling of that scalar to f mu nu. And then gluon fusion seems to be a good fit, especially given the luminosity ratio, if you have some coupling to g mu nu. And so if you wanted to write down a model, the first thing you would do is say, we know already with the Higgs and the standard model, we get couplings to photons and gluons by just coupling to standard model quarks. So let's do that for this state. And the problem is if you do that, if you couple the scalar to top quarks, because it's 750 GeV, the decays to TT bar are open. And so you immediately have an irreducible prediction for the ratio of branching ratios that's at the 10 to the minus 5 level. So the simplest thing you could do, which was just take a scalar, a pseudoscalar, and couple it to standard model fermions to get these production and decay modes, that doesn't work out just because of the open decay mode. So I don't actually think, again, we discussed this last week, we don't have any really good interpretation for a limit on a spin zero particle going to TT bar because of the interference. But at the very least, just the fact that these ratios of branching ratios are so large tells you that you really can't make it to work. So the leading message you get from this is if you have some new state and it's coupling to the standard model through loops of particles charged into the standard model, you need those particles, the things that it's coupling the standard model gauge bosons through, maybe they're fermions, maybe they're scalars, you need it to be heavier than 375 GeV so that it doesn't have an open decay mode to those fermions. So that's sort of, for the simplest models, that's the first thing we learn. Okay. Okay, now there's lots of things it could be. So even if it's a spin zero particle, it could be an elementary scalar, a pseudoscalar, it could be a glue ball, it could be a hyperonium, it could be a pion. Millions of papers have been written, millions of ships have sailed. There's lots of things it could be. The only thing we know is whatever the state is, it can inherit couplings to standard model particles through some loops of heavy particles that are charged under the standard model. So what's nice is, okay, either this, maybe it's an elementary scalar or pseudoscalar, maybe it's a bound state of some fermions or scalars. Whatever it is, if it inherits its couplings to photons through loops of particles that are charged into the standard model, then even if it's some crazy strongly coupled object, you actually have very sharp predictions for the ratios of branching ratios, depending on the representations of the matter that's connecting the resonance to the standard model. So you can just go ahead and make yourself tables of things. For example, if you imagine that the scalar couples to the standard model through loops of things with the quantum numbers of a down quark, or quantum numbers of an up quark, or quantum numbers of some crazy funny thing, or quantum numbers of a quark doublet, you have predictions for the ratios of branching ratios relative to gamma gamma. And what's nice about this is now you can just go, now you have a size for various effects and other dipoles on channels, so you know what it is, the size of the effects you should be looking for in other channels. Okay, so noteworthily, you know, lots of different representations, a very small Z gamma signal relative to gamma gamma, so something like half or even smaller depending on the representations. There's only something, in certain cases, you can get a large enhancement, but that's fairly special. For WW, you only get the case of WW if the thing connecting the resonance to the standard model is charged under SU2. And so for many cases, you just get nothing. But then typically, you get an interesting prediction for the case of WW. ZZ, in general, turns out to be very small. Then also, of course, there's ratio from gamma gamma to glu glu, depending on the color charge. Okay, so you can use this idea. It doesn't even matter if the resonance is strongly coupled. If you just have some specific representation coupling the resonance to the standard model, you have a whole set of expectations for the size of effects to look for in other diboson channels.
You should say all these numbers are ignoring and indexing.
That's right. These are assuming that the only portal between the scalar, the resonance, and the standard model is coming through loops of particles carrying these quantum numbers, or that the particle is actually made up of bound states of particles with these quantum numbers. Okay, so this is ignoring any effects that might come from mixing of the Higgs. I'll get to mixing of the Higgs in a second.
Got it, pseudoscalar.
You want it to be a pseudoscalar?
No.
Yes, you could call it a pseudoscalar to avoid, well, or we could have CP violation and CP is not well defined. Okay. All right, so a minimal model, so a very minimal model where you can predict both the rate and the branching ratios is just to take an elementary scalar and have loops of new particles, connecting it to photons and gluons, and depending on the representations, there's lots of things that can work. Okay. So now you can ask yourself the question, if you write down a minimal model, you can say, okay, now we have, right, we didn't have this in December, now we have a pretty good measurement of Z gamma at 13 TeV from both Atlas and CMS. So this is something that Marcus was showing last week. So here's the CMS analysis for Z gamma quoted as a limit on this production cross section times branching ratio to Z gamma. The same thing for Atlas. They have two different analyses, but the one that's relevant is just the one that looks at the left conic Z. And so the bounds you're getting are sort of in the 25 or 30 femtobarn level. But now you can just look at this table, right? If you have a 5 or 10 femtobarn cross section times branching ratio to photons, you can ask what you expect for Z gamma. And the answer is for almost all of these things connecting you between this resonance and standard model bosons, you predict a much smaller rate in Z gamma. So these are not yet even close to constraining. There is just one thing, one representation that's now a little stressed out, and that's if the resonance were connecting to standard model bosons through loops of things, heavy fermions, for example, that had the quantum numbers of a left-handed quark doublet, that is now in tension with Z gamma. Okay, you would have expected to see something in Z gamma for that particular portal. But for everything else, I think you just really don't need to get nervous. And so right now, we're at a point where the 13 TeV data set and other diboson final states, this certainly does not disfavor the diphoton interpretation. Okay. Does anyone else have any strong feelings about this? I think there's just no other diboson channels with relevant limits at this point.
Yeah, maybe it's worth mentioning, I think, if you take something that doesn't have a hypercharge, mm-hmm. but just SU2 quantum numbers, I think you have a little bit of tension with WW.
With ATV WW?
I think so.
Yeah, so also you see from these ratios, if you have any, so of course, as I've written it, everything I have has some hypercharge, but you can mostly ignore that. It's mostly coming from the SU2 quantum numbers.
Yeah.
If something's charged under SU2, you typically do get a big number for WW. Of course, at the same time, you know, CMS semileptonic WW at ATV has this, like, large suggestive excess. So.
Okay.
Depending on how you want to read the tea leaves. Okay.
So this curly Q has an exotic stable.
Yes. Yeah. So you would have to think of some. If this is a hypercharged, so you could certainly form bound states that would have. Yeah. So I'm not claiming to write down a full theory with this. I'm just giving you an example of what the numbers turn out to be. Okay. All right.
And you'll forget if you just take a single one of these representations. Yep. Can you get the one again?
Cross-section? So here for an elementary scalar, so what I've done is, if you assume you have a vector-like fermions, and they have a Kawa coupling of 1 to this resonance, as you go through the various representations, as you adjust the mass of those vector-like fermions, so it has to be heavier than 375, so you don't have an open mode,
right.
Taking 5 femtobarn to be the fiducial cross-section times branching ratio to gamma-gamma, if you have just one of them, okay, it's pretty hard to do.
Right.
But okay, it's very easy if you have two of them or three of them. It's very easy. All of these things can give you a good fit for the signal. Okay, and the masses of these fermions can be in the TV scale. Okay. Okay. So the next.
Sorry. Yeah. Going back to the dipotone channel, I'm just wondering, are there any analyses for gamma gamma star?
For gamma gamma star. Are there any analyses? I mean,
well, not at this point.
Yeah.
Because that's one thing you know, it has to be there, gamma gamma star.
But the ratio to gamma gamma is going to be small.
I understand it's going to be small.
So do you really expect sensitivity?
But that is the question. Do we know at what point we can get sensitivity? Because that's one thing that is slam dunk that is there. If gamma gamma is there, gamma gamma star has to be there.
But the way to think about it, that's like adding another channel that has less than a percent strength of this, so it'll never have a big impact. It'll be discovered here.
I would say I would always still look at other on-shell dipoles on channels before, but okay. It's a good thing to have. Okay, so now we get to the question of wide or narrow. So that's all I wanted to say, by the way, on do we have to get lucky twice? Again, I think the answer is we didn't. There's lots of interesting signal interpretations that are totally consistent with everything we know. And the other thing we learned is that the first place you would see it is diphotons. So no surprise there. Okay. So the next question you have, if you're thinking about what could this thing be, is this thing wide or narrow? Okay, so Atlas claims they have a preference for width that's about 6% of the mass of the particle. CMS has the highest significance for something that's narrow. It's a little hard to tell exactly how strong the Atlas preference is because it's all red, but the depth of the red is somewhat better. So asking a question related to is it wide or narrow and how should you think about this, Bill has done something very nice, which maybe he'll now tell us about briefly.
Thanks. So this was sort of something that came out of discussions here, and it's kind of highly preliminary, and certainly my own work, not Atlas's. But just, it's something I learned in 2012 when we were discovering these gamma gamma, was the observation that if you've got a background and you're looking for a resonance, you're sitting on some forward-moving background. If you don't know where the resonance is, you'll find somewhere under it a random background peak. So you'll actually not fit the correct point. You'll move off a little bit, and you'll pick up a neighboring peak. So if you've got a resonance of sort of two or three sigma type of significance, you'll add up a third of a sigma or something by having a neighboring peak and a randomness. So whenever you see a low significance peak or an unknown position, there's always an excess in the rate for that effect. And then I just started thinking this week, well, maybe the same thing happens here for width. If we're going to look at width, we don't have a peak position, we don't have a width position. What we were doing is a likelihood fit. To what extent can you pick up, if it's narrow, could you be faking width by picking up random fluctuations in the side? So what I've picked up here is just some Twine Monte Carlo tests. The background is an exponential. I generate events from an exponential background, and I insert a signal tuned so that on average I get back 3.6 sigma evidence for a new resonance.
What are they doing now?
So the dots. Black dots are, this is one pseudo experiment. I've just generated data from this model. So all you're going to do is go and fit thousands of these pseudo experiments.
And the 700 GeV peak is just a fluctuation.
No, this one has a 750 GeV peak. How this differs from what the experiments are doing. The experiments do lots of testing. They tell you correctly, I believe, the probabilities for seeing what you see if there's nothing there. I'm asking the question, what's the probability of seeing what you see if there is something there?
But you didn't put anything in it.
Yeah, I know I did. I put in a resonance.
What about the 700?
This is the point. You're dealing with a 3.5 sigma peak. And this peak I put in here is actually got a 45 GeV width in this example. So probably that actually is something to do. It's only one sigma width.
What do you do with the weight? When you toss the signal, what do you do with the weight?
You choose what width you want. I'm using a right figure. This particular toss is 45.
It's sweet, or are you let it?
When you toss the width, you choose a width that you hypothesize a particle. In this case, 45 GeV. There's one toy experiment with a 45 GeV particle. The point is that because this thing is so narrow, well, we'll see the point.
What experiments did you have to look at to get something to look like?
Yeah, I did play around for a nice, pretty one.
Look elsewhere.
Given where the answer here, many of them actually get a very narrow resonance. So, what happens? The plot on the left, if anyone wanted to look at here, The problem on the left is if you knew the width and you knew the rate, sorry, knew the mass and the width, you would fit back a rate that's falls in on this red distribution. Where here I've been injecting 23 events and I get back to 2.9, so consistent. If you don't know the width and you don't know the mass, you just don't even find it, well, it still gets about 23 on average, but the distribution is much wider because you're less controlled and with more flexibility and flopping.
What was the thing on the right
is the significance. This is actually calculated from difference in likelihoods between allowing a signal or not, 3.5 times goes on as cumulative. And you get more significance if you have that flop, because you go and find a place where you can get a bit more significance. That's the definition of what the thing will do. So it adds a bit more. It adds half a thing more significance, which is not totally negligible. All right, so why not now? So here what I've done is I show you the width that's fitted from a bunch of 30,000 experiments where there was a 45 dB width injected. And you see a range of 0 to 140. 25,000 experiments fit a width that's compatible with 0 width, half of them. And the rest flop around all over the plot with some fraction coming between 30 and 60. In other words, if you do genuinely have a real width, it's very hard to fit it. This is a pool plot, pool distribution, these with 20 sigma errors or something. Because once you've fitted a very narrow peak, you think, oh, it's a narrow peak with a narrow error. You think the 20 sigma will have a true value. So it's very easy, if you inject a 45 GF signal, to get a narrow bump coming out of it. That's 45 GF. Probability of getting something between 30 and 60 back is about 30%. If you start with a 4GF signal, which is, I think, the Atlas resolution, trying to read their confident, you've got just over 1% chance of getting a 45.
If you inject a true width of 45, what is the probability to get narrow?
To get between 30 and 60 back.
But I asked the question, re-CMS, of course. Okay.
It's about 50%. 30,000 experiments, 15,000 of them give you narrow.
So which means that the fact that the CMS do not get a width is not something against the Atlas.
That's my conclusion. Exactly. I set out to prove that it generated a width by mistake, but I think I'm finding the
rest. Can I ask the CMS question? What is it like even to find the width you find, assuming that the project has no width?
This is the final plot. If you put in the experimental resolutions of width, the problem is about 1% getting a width as wide as we actually saw. So I was expecting to see this much bigger number here. It is not what I expected to find, but
that's fine. Here you picked up just one point, because Atlas claims that the best fit is 45 GV. Right. Maybe another question is, let's assume you have a narrow resonance which is narrower than 4 GV. What is your probability to reconstruct finite width, namely wider than your experimental resolution?
Well,
summing of all the probabilities.
So it's summing it all. I haven't done that. I can very easily invert these graphs to give you that number. That's easy to do. I actually know that the average you get back from these fits is about the number you put in. So if you inject a width of 4, you get an average back of about 4. But since it's a spike at 0 and a long tail, it doesn't tell you the probabilities.
Oh, but then actually there's nothing wrong with sitting somewhere on the tail.
It's probably reasonable to suggest a width of 15 GV, and you've only got 10-15% chance of getting a width in the region Atlas finds.
I think you're saying that even if hypothetically, as we have more data, then the experimental width becomes narrower and narrower, that's still not saying that the true width is narrow.
If you double the signal injected, you get a much closer approximation to the true signal back. It quite rapidly converges. But this is at this kind of drift stage.
I think that's worth a tongue round of applause, because Bill did that too. So that's all I wanted to add on the question of wide versus narrow. Okay, the question of is it resonance or not? So the native, the simple thing to imagine when you see a bump in an invariant mass distribution is it is in fact a resonance. But you could imagine lots of stories where the thing that you saw at 750 GeV, maybe it was actually something that was being produced with some other particle, and then maybe you missed that other particle because it was going to soft hadronic stuff or invisible stuff. So instead of imagining that you had to resonantly produce a single state and have it decay to photons, you could be imagining that you were producing some heavier parent resonance that was going to the thing that gave you that photons plus some other stuff. And you would there'd be various reasons why you might want to do this. You might have an easier time getting a relatively large width inferred from the invariant mass distribution. You could have an easier time getting the rates to all work out. And of course, it's just a natural possibility that you shouldn't rule out until you've excluded. All we had to go on December 15th was just the words, spoken words, no indication of additional metahadronic activity. This is now better quantified at Morion, so Atlas released a lot of interesting distributions for their diphoton events. And so there were some predictions for if it were one of various possible cascades that were giving you the diphoton excess plus some other thing, you'd have various distributions. And so maybe, Sabina, do you want to say, or is she? Is she here? Oh, yes, great. Would you want to say anything briefly about this? I've just shown two of your distributions and some Atlas data, but since this was your work, if you have any comments you want to add. So this is showing, for example, the PT of the gamma-gamma system for the simplest resonant interpretation, so there's obviously some very fast-falling PT spectrum, versus one of any possible other models, which are, you know, where the diphoton resonance is produced with something else in a sort of three-particle vertex, or where the pairs of photons come off with an additional state, or where you have some state that's being produced in the initial part of the process and some final state, or something where the photons are actually coming through some split part of a cascade. So these different models give you different predictions for example, the PT spectrum of the photon pair, and also for the missing energy spectrum. And now you can compare these. Now we have very nice data from Atlas that's actually showing us both Chirpa predictions for the distributions of these quantities and also the data points. So, okay, there's not a lot of data, so it's all a little bit noisy, but at the right now there's fairly good agreement with just the background prediction. The background prediction is also not very different from just the spin zero resonance interpretation. So I'd say right now...
You want to tell me you can see through your eye?
Well, I mean, it's not totally obvious.
Yeah, up to 1,000, it's linear up to 600.
I guess there's certainly not enough data to interpret anything very strongly, but it would have run the other way. Like, had there been, you might have hoped to get some suggestion that it wasn't just background-like or a resonance from these distributions. And as far, within the current nature of the noisy data, there's no suggestion of that. Okay, so we've just seen early distributions. There's not statistically any significance here. I haven't done any sort of likelihood. But there's no preference for other...
But you can see visually that certain things cannot be, right? The
green curve is looking...
Certain cannot be, and the red curve...
There's some missing data points at 200 and 325.
The missing data points here, yeah. So I don't maybe a Atlas member. I don't actually. Yeah.
Zero. Well, that is zero.
I mean, the resonance is produced because there's some missing heat.
Yeah, there's no strong indication, for example, of missing energy associations.
Do you know what the S of O D is in that mass bench?
What was the question?
Yeah, so this is, by the way, this is a window that's between... I'm showing the wrong plot, although the correct window actually looks the same. So I tried to show plots from 700 to 840. So it is a range that includes background in addition to signal. It's not a whole lot, because above 700, there's not a lot of events, right? So you would say this is mostly dominated by events in the bump. But there's just no strong suggestion for it. So that's at the level that we have now that we have some differential distributions, at least from Atlas, there's no suggestion that there's a wide amount of extra event activity associated with this.
So
right now.
1, 2, 3, 4, that is the way that...
They plotted, yeah, I think this is one, that's two.
So among those, one seems to be the best, right?
Well, and one is the best, but then the black is just the
same. Of course.
The background is probably the best.
And you can optimize by thinking the loss. Difference is such that...
that the shift to the left. I can imagine.
If you increase the mass difference, or you can make the second scalar, if you need it, so very light, and then you get the right flash curve, which is, again, not even to go.
Very good. Okay. This question, since we are in Higgs weeks, is it a Higgs? So the answer appears to be no to within the current data set. So the two simplest things I might think about is maybe this thing inherits its couplings to the standard model just by being a singlet that mixes with the Higgs. And the reason that's disfavored is, okay, so if you have a Higgs that mixes with, the singlet mixes with the Higgs, it can pick up, of course, a coupling of diphotons. So you have a, that's a function of some mixing angle between the singlet and the Higgs. But then it's just inheriting the coupling diphotons coming from the Higgs. So you have some prediction for that partial width. Of course, if it's mixing with the Higgs, it also then gives you a prediction for the partial width of decays into WWs with the longitudinal enhancement. And so now you can just take the ratio of these two to come up with a prediction for the decays to gamma-gamma versus decays to WW that doesn't depend on the mixing angle, right? So if you take that ratio, you find that you're immediately put in the territory of having decays to gamma-gamma at the 10 to the minus 5 level relative to decays to WW, right? So because the mixing angle drops out of this ratio, there's no game you can play if it's a singlet. It just tells you you should have had a whomping signal into WW, and we certainly don't see that. So the very strong suggestion is this is not something that's getting its couplings to the standard model by mixing with the Higgs. Okay, so that's a zeroth order statement you can make. Now you can say, oh, but look, we've already heard, and we'll hear a little bit more tomorrow, that if I have a two Higgs doublet model, there's an alignment limit where there are second scalar or pseudoscalar whose couplings to vector bosons can be turned to zero by going to some alignment limit. Can't I do that and then make this story go away? So if that's what's happening, if you're in a two Higgs doublet model, you can still, of course, get the coupling to photons through the top loop. But the problem is, this is the problem that we encountered at the very beginning in the simple signal interpretation. If it's coupling to photons through the top loop, because it's at 750, decays to tops are open. And so that kicks down your branching ratio. And in a two Higgs doublet model, you can turn everything to 11, add a scalar and a pseudoscalar, ask what's the biggest signal you can get. And the biggest signal you can get is a 0.01 femtobarn. And that drops with tangent beta. So this also appears to be a bad explanation. So in zeroth order, this is not a Higgs. But does anyone have
different that thoughts? Argument breaks down at least a little bit when you include some new particles.
Look, if I write down a two Higgs doublet model and I write down vector-like particles, and now I can do a fit that depends on their coupling to the Higgs and the coupling to these guys. So certainly I can enlarge my model. But there's no sort of minimal just extension of the Higgs sector alone that's going to do it for you. You still need this portal of new vector-like particles that are kinematically forbidden to decay into. And once you do that, you have all these predictions that I showed you earlier for rations and branching ratios. You can start to throw those off by turning on some amount of Higgs mixing. So if you have Higgs mixing on the order of 10 to the minus 3, right, then you can start to pick up some of these branching ratios and change your conclusions. But it's not going to be a large contribution from Higgs mixing.
But because of this big ratio, it has to be a pretty tiny mixing.
Yeah, exactly. The mixing has to be very tiny for this not to kill you. Yeah, so that's why I said 10 to the minus 3. So you could mix with the Higgs at the 10 minus 3 level, but not much more, because otherwise you just killed by WW. Longitudinal WW sucks.
But in the right side, you took also SUSY loops into account.
So you can certainly turn on sparticle loops as an extra contribution. Scalars are actually not great for this state, right? The just for the rate, the contribution from scalar loops is down relative to fermions by a factor of 6. And so you actually have to really turn everything past 11 to get sparticle loops to make everything work. And you still have, if it's a two Higgs doublet model, right, you still are coupling to tops at some level, and you have to account for the fact that that is a branching ratio, even if it's not giving you all the couplings to photons. So it's very, very hard, although maybe Carlos disagrees, but I think
it's very
hard,
really.
Even the MSSM.
Yeah.
Very hard.
There's still this proposal that the scheme of the case you could really
like two scalars. Yes, so I'm going to mention that at the end, the diphotons and tetraphotons, which is a way to get around to lots of problems with this, but let's... let's make cookies. So we've got 15 minutes to wrap the discussion. I did want to discuss the question of who ordered that, to which my field. So we alluded earlier today about square pegs and round holes. So the first thing to try is, okay, could this be supersymmetry? The answer is it's not obvious out of the box, but necessity is the mother of invention. So here's, I think, three of the leading SUSY interpretations. A very interesting idea that Sophie and co-authors at Cambridge were involved in was saying, well, okay, so neutrino has the right quantum numbers, and so maybe we can make this work in an R-parity violating scenario. So the idea is if you have a QLD-type superpotential coupling, that gives you a way to produce this neutrino through pairs through QQ bar. And then if you have an LLE-A term, now you have a coupling of neutrinos to staus. And now you have a Stau loop giving you diphotons. And because these are coming from two parametrically different things, you don't have to, you know, you can get some partial width to photons and not worry about getting swamped necessarily by decays in the quarks. Now, to make this all work, this gives you a prediction for the mass scale of the Staus. So they have some parameter space that's a function of one of the couplings and the mass of the Staus. And there's sort of a favored region that puts the Staus between 375 and 390. The only thing that I'm concerned about is this is naively, you know, we already saw the ATV data is that most compatible with the excess if it's gluon fusion initiated. So there seems to be some issue with the fact that this is quark initiated, but that's sort of, you know, that's using ingredients you have in SUSY to make it work.
What if you had VB bar fusion?
What if you had VB bar fusion? So,
you may not have
VB. Yeah, there's, well, and there, you want, yeah, so that's an interesting question. I haven't, I know. So, do you guys think about this?
What was the question?
Are there other production modes, for example? Well, it's hard to imagine how you get VB bar fusion to neutrinos. I guess you would want a QLD.
We'll not change the picture.
Asymmetrization. I don't think it. The luminosity ratio is 5 for bottoms. That may be a better explanation.
No, but you need a much.
Can the cross section be big enough
if it's B? The cross section also does the branching ratio once you've thrown in the decay to B's. So I don't know if those things all work.
Well, I think there's just not enough bees in the
group. Okay, you have
to start the wrong. You need a really large cross section. No, the real problem with this model, so far as when I read it, at least, is that the A term that you need is huge.
Yes, you're required to have a large RPV.
That is a real problem. Because if not, you cannot overcome the branching ratio.
Okay, there's a Skoltsino, quote-unquote Skoltsino explanation. I put scare quotes because it's not an actual Skoltsino of the primary SUSY breaking. So this is the idea that there's a SUSY breaking multiplet, and there's a Goldstone fermion associated with that, the Goldstino, and then there's a scalar part of the multiplet that actually inherits some couplings, but it depends, those couplings depend on the SUSY breaking scale. And to make everything work, a couple of things go wrong. One is the scale of SUSY breaking has to be very low, so this is not the actual Skoltsino. It's like some separate sector that partially breaks supersymmetry, if you believe that's sensible. And the other thing is, because your predictions depend on the Gaugino masses, you are ruled out by a Gluino mass bound before you get the rates to all work out.
Sorry, what is phi in this model?
So phi is the Skoltsino. I don't even really want to get into it.
It's a scalar.
All right. This is not the model of the universe, and there's lots of problems with it.
It's a scalar component of the multiplet that has it.
I got it.
All right. Final thing is, okay, if we extend the MSSM to give us Dirac Gaugino's or to have an n equals 2 vector sector, then, of course, the extended multiplet for hypercharge contains a scalar that is an adjoint of U1, which has the right quantum numbers. So the Spino could also be the candidate. The problem is, in a minimal Dirac Gaugino model, to get the rate and everything to work, the Dirac Gaugino mass parameter has to be 10 TeV, and then there's some huge tuning to get something down at 750. All right, so this also seems a little challenging, but it's an idea. Okay, no further comment. Okay, I'm thinking about physics beyond the standard model, solving the hierarchy problem, compositeness. So, you know, compositeness.
So this is funny because it seems that the answer is no. Yeah. No, according to science and stuff, but this is an author.
So what's the basic idea? So most of the time, if we focus on composite Higgs models to address the hierarchy problem, we consider minimal cosets that just give us the right number of Goldstones to build a one electric doublet. But of course, if you have a more elaborate pattern of global symmetry breaking, you get more than full Goldstones, and those can arrange themselves in different standard model representations. So more elaborate cosets tell you have more parametrically light scalars, and so you could have an extra scalar at 750, and still all the stuff associated with compositeness could be at multi-TeV level, and everything would work. So this particular pattern of breaking is attractive, because SO6 to SO5 gives you 5 Goldstones, 5 to 4 gives you 4, so you sort of organize yourself into having a singlet and 2 doublets, and you know, because this is a composite Higgs model, as we heard from Kaustub last week, we expect lots of additional vector-like fermions from heavy fermionic resonances. So this idea that we have some portal states that connect the scalar to the standard model, those are already an intrinsic ingredient, and the mass scale is about right. Okay. So if you had to pick which one of these is going to be the 750 GeV state, There's some singlet doublet mixing that rules it out for the Higgs mixing reason we already talked about, but you sort of have a sterile doublet, and maybe that can be it. I think the lesson is, it's nothing that shows up in minimal models, but certainly non-minimal cosets. You can get the extra scalar states, and you already have a vector-like fermions charge into the standard model that can give you the coupling to gauge bosons. Okay. The final thing you could bring up is in models of warped extra dimensions and addressing the hierarchy problem, whether or not the standard model propagates in the bulk, you have a KK resonance of the graviton, spin 2 particle, and this is something that some of the original signal interpretations by the experimental collaborations were precisely in terms of a KK graviton. And so you can ask the question, does a KK graviton actually make sense? So the minimal model is highly predictive. Basically, you just have a dimensionful parameter that controls the overall coupling of this spin 2 particle to energy momentum tensor, and then that gives you a super predictive set of ratios, of branching ratios, for this particle. And the thing to pay attention to, most of these, so the branching ratio of the gamma-gamma is about 5%. Most of these are irrelevant in terms of their sensitivity. Dihiggs, the branching ratio is 0.6%, so well below experimental sensitivity. But the dileptine branching ratio is the same as diphoton. And so the fact that we have very good dileptin downs now gives you a big problem. So you can go ahead and interpret, as Steve and Howe did, what is the bound coming from dileptons. And they just put the individual channel bounds. I made a little ghetto combined limit here. So if you just took the diphoton data and you were fitting this model, so you picked the KK gravitons of 750, and then you picked the scale to match the rate, you have some significance that's favored by the diphoton signal. But then if you add in dilepton, okay, it pushes the scale way up, which means you're pushing all the rates way down, and it really gives you something like, a very poor agreement with the diphoton excess. Okay. So I would say dileptons really make this less attractive. All right. The final thing on who ordered that, yes?
Just the general question about jet.
Yes.
What is the, there have been searches for bumps in jets. And
it's 3 orders of magnitude.
None have seen.
3 orders of magnitude. The ratio of sensitivity is 3 orders of magnitude. It's like, it's plus the few picobarn level. Yeah.
Okay.
It's not even that.
It's not even that, yeah. It's 10 picobarn level. So you're 3 orders of magnitude off. So I'd say most things are not at all in tension with existing diejet data. It would be great to see more of these sort of scouted, right? So we also need, obviously, now diejet data that's sensitive to 750. So that requires careful analyses, but that would be great to get more of that. Yes, Sabina?
I don't remember the details, but there was another paper by Sean Hewitt and then Fabrizio also the newer.
Oh, well, I'm just saying. So there are various papers. What's that?
I mean, they claim it's they can pick the model.
Where the standard model lives on one brain, but they have one parameter, and the standard model is all localized. I think you can only make it work if you start putting the standard model fields in the bulk, and then you have, of course, different factors for different fields, and now, of course, and then you can erase entirely the dileptin bounds. You can also do things like turn on brain-localized kinetic terms. Okay, there are other games you can play, but the minimal, so certainly there are other games one can play, and probably brain-localized kinetic terms is a piece of the answer. The brain-localized kinetic terms also start to warp profiles, so it gives you extra parameter freedom. So you can be viable if you, but the minimal one parameter thing is disfavored.
So I didn't see the radian on your list here yet.
Okay, yes. So I haven't had much to say about the radian. Well, maybe you can tell us how you feel the radian stacks up.
Well, I think it's doing very well. Your answer, of course. But I can't go into details. Be happy to make a presentation some other time. So.
Well, and maybe if you want to append 5 minutes to your 2 Higgs double model talk tomorrow, we can add that as the radian interpretation of 750. I'd say the more general message, though, to me is, okay, look, most of the standard model field content hasn't been deeply motivated by theory considerations, right? So just having extra stuff doesn't shock me. Also, no one said that beyond standard model physics had to be minimal. Certainly, again, nothing in the standard model we've seen followed that pattern. So, whether you're disturbed about there not being an obvious who ordered that, I don't think one should be very disturbed. The other thing, of course, a point that Paul has made in the past is if you actually try to write down a real complete UV theory, for example, in string theory, they give you the standard model field content at low energies, you also get typically a bunch of somewhat parametrically light exotics that are very often vector-like under the standard model, but chiral with respect to other global symmetries. And so these fields have reasons to be light. And so there's lots of pictures of UV physics beyond the standard model where having an extra sector with additional fields and maybe vector-like matter connecting them is not totally unreasonable. And then my final perspective is, you know, there's no atheist in foxholes, so if this is a real signal, I really don't care if it's supersymmetry or not, because it's the greatest thing that's ever happened in the history of particle physics. Okay.
In your lifetime.
In my lifetime. Okay, so then there's a question of what next. It's not really worth belaboring this point. Depending on what your exact model is, you know, the fact that if this scalar has some portal to the standard model that gives you a diphoton rate, you have general predictions for lots of other diboson rates to look at 750. And then depending on exactly how you make your resonance, you can get extra signals that you can look for elsewhere. So the general lesson from all these things is there should be new physics around the TEV scale associated with this particle. I don't know that there's anything that's suggested in this context that we're not already looking for in some way, but possibly that could be the case. So I think the answer to the experimental program to follow up on this is already underway. I don't have much to add, but maybe other people have things to add, unless we're into cookie town. So that's all I want to say. So we have all these questions. Is there anything?
There was a comment about the light scale scalar again to 2.4.
Yeah, okay, good. So I didn't make slides about this. So this came up, this reared its head before the Higgs discovery, and then at the Higgs discovery when Atlas diphoton was high, and then it's reared its head in about 50 different papers with 750 GeV resonance. So of course, there's also the possibility, if we have a particle at 750 GeV, and for example, it decayed to pairs of light pseudoscalars, and those pseudoscalars then went into pions, and those pions went into photons, or the pseudoscalars mixed with pions, and the pions decayed to photons. Those photons, of course, would be boosted and highly collimated, and each pair of photons would largely be reconstructed as a single photon. So that's a perfectly reasonable interpretation of this excess. It's more reasonable. So at 125 GeV, if you were telling the story with the Higgs, it starts to become a slightly marginal game because your chances of always putting the pairs of photons into a single reconstructed photon isn't 100%. But if you have a 750 GeV resonance decaying to pairs of things that mix with pi zeros, the chance that the pairs of photons get resolved as a single photon is pretty much 100%. And it's a very reasonable interpretation. It's very easy then to write down models, because now you don't have to write down some portal state to give you a coupling to photons, right? You just have to have some coupling to these pseudos. The pseudos have some mixture with the pi zero, and kinematically maybe the only thing they can do is decay to pairs of photons. So there are many papers that have been written about this at this point. It is a very sensible signal interpretation. That is going to require a very different set of techniques to try to resolve, are the photons that show up in all of these events actual photons or collimated pairs of photons? So that's an interesting question to push forward.
Just use the conversion probability once you get more.
Yes. So the zeroth order thing, of course, is, yeah, you look at converted photons and the fact that if you have two photons in what you think is a photon, your conversion probability in the inner part of the detector is higher. And so you can, in fact, use that to discriminate these different proposals.
It's also true that many of these models are substantial decay lengths, right?
Yes. So there's a possibility. That's right. And so there's a large possibility that there's a displaced decay that's within the length of the inner detector. So even if it's displaced, it still gets resolved as a single photon by the time it hits the ECAL. But yeah, you basically use it. Yeah, there's a tail, yeah, absolutely. So you can pick up fractions of displaced decays. You can look at the conversion. So yeah, there have been a couple papers about this already. It's also a very sensible possibility. Does anyone else have something to add to that?
I had a question for the experimentalists. So I have Sheldon Stone constantly whispering into my ear something about the energy calibration of the photons and in comparison, comparing Atlas to CMS. You know, the question is the bump really in the same place? So I was wondering what is involved in doing the calibration up at 750 GeV, since there's not a lot of stuff to calibrate on up there. So I was wondering if there were any comments on that from Atlas and CMS people. He's the curmudgeon of curmudgeons, and so he's always telling me not to pay any attention because of the calibrations. So I thought I'd raise the question here.
So it's a coincidence.
How much tension is
there? Alice, do they know what they can calibrate on those photons? Alice, do they know what they can calibrate on those photons?
You can extrapolate from the electron.
Well, I think they use E plus E minus from Z to do their calibration, right?
That's where you get the absolute.
But it's done well, far away from 750, away. Yeah.
Well, I thought they ran out to pretty high energy now in that calibration. I may be wrong. I thought I read something about that.
I would forget about this. I don't know.
So I can enjoy my lunches a little bit more and not listen to.
I do know that we cannot put the jets off of this sort of energy, and that we put out a correction only this morning at 0.3 per mil. No, 0.03 per mil. So that's the kind of precision that it's aiming for.
Anything else people want to discuss?
We actually have a statement in the notes about to deliver the statement.
Well, what is the next channel? I mean, if you go back one slide.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these modes, based on the models, you might expect certain to show up before others. Like digets, the problem in many models just hopeless. Right?
So digets is very often hopeless.
So what is the best? Is Z gamma or is WW?
So they're about the same, right? So Z gamma is somewhat easier to do. Semi-electronic WW is harder to do. But once you get semi-electronic, if you have SU2 quantum numbers, there's a much larger WW branching ratio. And on the other hand, you could have zero WW branching ratio, right? So the only thing that's guaranteed in this game that you'll have sensitivity to is Z-gamma. And Z-gamma just needs to improve statistics. WW, we just need to see, and it's just hard to do with semi-leptonic WW, so we have to wait. But those are the two, I think, that I would be more, ZZ, the problem is, based on the boson mixing in the standard model, the ZZ rates are low, and then picking up the ZZ rate that you're sensitive to is even worse. So really what we have to do, the first thing that's going to happen is we're going to get more gamma-gamma data, and that's going to be the first indication that we have whether or not we should keep being excited.
Just to follow up the vector-like quirk searches, I think that's the most interesting thing. This has got to be, most of these models, something new colored.
Absolutely, and so let me give you
a... dependent are the decay modes?
So once you specify the representation, then you can even figure out, okay, there's only a few things you could decay to in the standard model. Many of them fall into the acceptance of existing vector-like quirk searches. The mass scale for this, once you specify the representation, assuming sort of largish order one Yukawa couplings, if you get the diphoton rate, these mass scales are 600 to GeV to a TeV. Right now we're at about the 750 GeV level, obviously, for T primes, and so that will get there. But I think the rate of progress on vector-like quirk searches is not going to be that great, just because of the pair produced.
Do you need new gauge interactions to keep those perturbative
case? If you wanted to write down a perturbative model, like an order one Yukawa coupling, it needs a new gauge interaction. But you could write those down, right? These things could be charged into the standard model and some extra gauge group. Maybe the gauge group confines. That could certainly be done.
So
I think Jay had the drop on you, but then I'll...
I haven't been following things super well since the wealth of papers, but we had our own thing about a more simple model where this thing is produced via gamma fusion.
Luminosity ratio, it's hard, right? Even if you take, I would say it is the most minimal model, and it was very clever of you guys to write it down, but it's very hard to make the luminosity ratio work. Okay. So there's strong tension with the ATV results. ATV.
I would like to return back to the vector-like representation. So it's true that you can look for them, look for them directly, but there is another channel that you haven't mentioned that you have a good chance to see them indirectly in Drell-Young measurements, because in fact, especially if you would like to really fit high width, you will need a relatively large NQ squared when Q is the charge. So this will affect the Drell-Young production. So the constraints that that you get right now from Drell-Young as measured at 8 TeV and Y parameter measurement at lab are still not, I would say, strong enough. But at 13 TeV, already starting from 10 inner center band, you will start getting... It might become visible.
So yeah, that's
which great. Is a very high MLL.
Right. So yeah, I don't know what the prospects of that are, but yeah, Andre's general point is if you have large electric representations and the mass scale is not well above the TV scale, you should be able to see it. Which is a great point.
Bill. As far as the digets go, you're rather dismissive of them being 3 orders of magnitude less. The Atlas data is mostly derived.
But sir, that was in the graviton. In this class of models, see, they're not.
I was going to say the Atlas results are from one inverse femtobarn of 7 TV data.
Exactly. Well, and that's because you have to use, obviously, the data set you can use to get sensitivity at 750 is a reduced data set. Right. So that's what limits your luminosity. But yeah, I mean, you can ask what are the, you certainly have rates that are large enough that you could start picking them up. I think the story is now our current sensitivity with 8 TeV analyses is not quite there, but certainly you do enough scouted data at 13 TeV.
It's not that far.
Yeah, it's not that far.
For example, to see that first one where it's
So yeah, I wouldn't say in general it's hopeless. There are certainly theories where you can start to pick it up.
So you can try to select for gluonic jets a little bit too, reduce the background.
That's an interesting. I don't know how hard of a game that is. Okay. Well, there's a clamoring for cookies, but unless there's anything else, thank you guys. This was a very interesting discussion.